is it? I'm going to open the meeting.
That's right.
Just call the meeting to order.
Well, don't wrinkle it or get papers. Or double fold them or do the crossword.
Okay, the first bill we're going to take up today is House Bill 837.
You got one of the bills left.
They don't take them out of here once we pass them out.
Well, why don't we?
Well, there was a request by a couple of committee members that they be kept filed for the sanctity reference.
So even if the bill passes out?
They want to use it for backup.
Okay, Representative Meekins, the chief sponsor, is here on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is an attempt to sort of equalize the situation for multiple pain to deaf people or persons that are hearing impaired one way or another and cannot, when they're arrested or when they're a witness, they have real problems. The basic problem, I think, is in understanding what's going on, but also they can't really participate in their defense, and there's some real danger of a person who is deaf and therefore can't defend himself of becoming involved in the court system and even going to jail for offenses that they didn't commit or were not guilty of. So this bill is just an attempt to make this equal. It won't cost very much money. There's 150 deaf in the state, and however many times they might go to court, times the cost of an interpreter for their time in court would be the fiscal note on it. But there are some problems with this bill, and I do have some changes that I'd like the committee to make in it. On page 1, line 12, is the first reference, and they're calling it here handicapped person. This is a copied word for word from Oregon law, and it doesn't apply in some cases. Handicapped, I think, is the wrong word. It connotates, it is defined in the bill correctly, but the word handicapped connotates a lot of things that we're not talking about here, and so I'd like to have that replaced with deaf. And then keep the same definition of handicap, but just make it for deaf. But I'll talk about that definition when I get to it. Then on the first section, then explaining the bill. The first section says,
"Could I ask you a question?"
Yes.
There's a statement from the department here, and they use instead of using the definition, they use person in need as an interpreter.
Did you see the position?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Thank you.
They use that phrase instead.
It's suggested changes to the bill.
That's what I have in mind too. I don't have any preference.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman. It's the same. I think it's the same intent exactly. Because we don't want somebody getting confused that a person in a wheelchair needs an interpreter. They can hear.
Okay.
Now, the first section then would just be that whenever a witness or a party in a civil or criminal proceeding is deaf, the court shall appoint a qualified interpreter unless the person doesn't want one. And the section B then just says that how the fees would be fixed and that that in a criminal proceeding the state or the municipality shall pay the fees and expenses of a qualified interpreter for the defendant or his witness. And then it qualifies that with two statements. I'd like to take those out of there. I don't think number one and number two need to be in there. I don't know why Oregon has them in there, but I think they're totally irrelevant. If the person's deaf, they need an interpreter. If the state's calling them, then I think the state should equalize the situation and pay for the interpreter. It's not that much money, and I think it's fair. But I think that on line 21 on page 1, we'd have to, I don't know if I guess a lawyer would have to look at this and see if just a period after witness and deleting the if, everything after if, down to line 28, would be sufficient. I'm not sure. You might have to say, if one is appointed, then they pay the fees, because it says something about a qualified interpreter for the defendant or his witness. And I don't know if I'm not talking about every defendant, so anyway, you understand my intent.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Russ, the way it's written right now, the definition of EDF, as you would propose to change it, or handicapped person, seems to be very broad, so it includes anyone who would need an interpreter, even if the reason were a difference in language rather than a hearing deficiency.
Yes.
So is that your intention?
Mr. Chairman? No, it's not. And I'll speak to that section now since you brought it up. I was going to make that point. I have Dick Bradley redrafting this with the intent. The phrase, because he is deaf or because he has a physical hearing impairment or physical speaking impairment, is supposed to modify all of those other phrases, all those other clauses. I think maybe it does legally, maybe it doesn't. We're going to rewrite it to read this way. Deaf person means a person who, because he is deaf or because he has a physical hearing impairment or physical speaking impairment, cannot readily understand or cannot understand the proceedings or is incapable of presenting, like that. Would that satisfy your complaint?
It's not a complaint, it's just a question.
Or your...
It does answer the question. What is done now in the courts when this problem arises?
Well, I'm not sure what the... We don't pay for it. I think it's handled differently in different parts of the state. In Juneau, for instance, there's not a qualified interpreter in Juneau most of the time, and according to what I understood yesterday. And Mr. Buckner, for example, has come down from Anchorage at my request so that he could do the interpreting. So it's handled differently. And I think in some jurisdictions, the deaf people probably get off easier than they would otherwise because the persons involved are afraid of getting in some sort of a discriminatory situation. But in other circumstances, I think it's a real problem. And we've got a person that's going to testify about their own case, an actual example of what might happen, what did happen. So it might be instructive in a few minutes.
But Mr. Chairman, I heard Miss Burke paged at the Baranoff Hotel at lunch today, so she may be in town. I don't want to hold up the bill, but it'd be interesting to find out if the court system has any position on this bill. I think I'm in favor of it, but I'm happy to know there's someone here who can give us a first-person experience dealing with our court system. But I'd also like to find out if the court system has or thinks that they have any kind of policy on this now. I've never run into the problem in nine years practicing law. I might have, but it just turned out I haven't. No doubt, I understand.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Mr. Buckner as soon as I finish to get his feeling on the bill, and he has had some experience with it. Of course, the original request was generated from the deaf community and the persons who work with the deaf, because they're the ones that run into the actual problem. And so, part of those concerns, I think, can be addressed then, and I'll just defer that to then. I'm sure the court system would favor the bill.
Mr. Chairman. Yes, Your
Honor. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Meekins, at some point it spoke of not being able to understand the English language as though you were trying to include people who,
Ms. Red, that's the same question that Fred talked about. We're changing that language so that it addresses that. See, as you read it currently, it could include a Korean who possibly couldn't understand the English language, or someone who was mentally retarded who couldn't participate in their defense. But what it's supposed to say is someone who can't do those things because he's deaf. And it does say that, but because it's such a long sentence, by the time you get to the because, you forget that it modifies the person that's the antecedent to it way back there. So we're just going to switch the language around it.
Okay, but I wanted to follow up on that by saying that, or asking the question, Mr. Chairman, if anyone knows the answer. There have been cases I think I've heard of where Native people, for instance, who don't speak the English language are not able to assist in their own defense. Are you aware of whether that problem is being taken care of by the courts now? Do they provide interpreters for Native people? Or might it be desirable to include that kind of thing still?
I think they do it.
Well, I know they have done it, but I don't know whether there's a requirement and whether it's done across the board. And I also don't know whether it's desirable to do it in the context of this bill, but now that the subject's been raised, I think we ought to deal with it too.
I think that they've got it somewhere in the civil rules or something like that. I think they have a policy.
Well, the reason that I think we should check into that is a good point. The reason I think they do is that when I was really approaching this fellow, this person talking to me said that they thought it was only fair that since the court provides interpreters in other cases, that they ought to provide that in this case, because it's a similar kind of concept. And I agreed very quickly and said, well, if that's the case, then yes, I'd be happy to put the bill in place. So I've been working on that assumption, but I haven't actually researched a lot to see what's in the statute, but I'll do that immediately after this meeting.
Mr.
understand?
Well, they do. They do appoint interpreters. I think the question is, I know of many cases that they do, but now whether they're paid or not, I don't know. We'd have to check the rule, but they certainly do furnish interpreters. If the person can't understand the procedure.
Yeah, I know they have done it. How regular the practice is and whether they pay for them, I don't know.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, just to go on and explain the bill, then, of course, there's different kinds of court proceedings. We're talking about when the state, basically, there's when the state generates it and the state pays for it. If there's a civil proceeding, the person who's requiring the interpreter, who's requiring the witness, I mean, pays for the interpreter. So I think that's only fair. If you were suing Dankworth, whoever wanted the deaf person as the witness would have to pay for the interpreter. And then, I also think that this definition, the definition needs to be redone here on line 3 of page 2. Then, starting on line 12, handicapped person, this is talking about interrogation and arrest, and what it provides, that, and I think, indeed, we should not use handicapped person here, because that really confuses things. I think we should use the word deaf person, or person in need of an interpreter. But I think I would prefer deaf, because it's more limited than person in need of an interpreter. That's just my own opinion. But upon the arrest of a deaf person, and before interrogating or taking a statement of a deaf person, the arresting officer, or when the arrest is by a private person, the officer to whom the handicapped person is delivered shall make available to the handicapped person before an interrogation or the taken statement a qualified interpreter to assist the handicapped person. So I think that's needed, because that's where you run into a lot of problems. Even if you just got in a car wreck and you're trying to take statements from people and interrogating to see who was at fault, for instance, and the person's deaf, they can't explain their case, and you might get a real one-sided argument and bust the wrong person. So I'm going to show you that. I think you should delete, again, from line 22 to the rest of that page, that language there, because I don't think we need to qualify that by if the person has means or not, or if they make a verified statement. And by the way, one of the problems with this is that you're requiring somebody who, it's a catch-22, they may not be able to make a written statement, that you're requiring them to make a written statement because they can't speak and they can't do either, and so they can't get an interpreter to interpret themselves until they make a written statement, and they can't make that either. And I think that's an element of bureaucratic craziness that doesn't need to be in this bill. So it should be, if they're deaf, they need an interpreter, then you appoint. Okay, then the next thing would be the same concept in an administrative hearing, and it's the same idea. And the same thing should be deleted, I think, on line 22, page 3, down to line 28. Also, of course, it provides that if the deaf person does not wish an interpreter, even though one could be appointed for him or her, they don't need it. One need not be appointed. So, and that's all I have, unless there are any questions on the bill. I'd like to have Mr. Bruckner testify next, Mr. Chairman, and then he is going to interpret for Arlie Dominguez, who is deaf and lives in Juneau, and had a run-in with this problem, and I'd like to give his case just as an example.
Mr. Chairman, I would also recommend to Mr. Meekins, in preparing this changed definition, that you use words that are tighter than the words cannot readily understand or communicate the English language, or communicate the English language, because it could be argued by someone that, well, if somebody can read and write, you can always use a notepad, but that's not a very good way. I think you want to refer specifically to auditory and oral responses in your definition, because I, from just courtroom work, I know that the written responses and questions just don't go, considering what hearings and trials are really for.
Okay, that's good. I assume that Mr. Bradley will do that, but I'll tell him.
Yeah. Russ, in the research that you've done on this, have you found any specific problems in judicial or administrative hearings that relate to blind?
No, I haven't. I've thought about that. I think that they're already covered, but I'm not sure.
But you haven't found any specific problems like
no.
the problem we're addressing here is a very limited one.
No, the people that I've been talking to work for the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, and they run into these kind of problems. They help not only the deaf people, but all types of handicap and otherwise.
Okay, fine.
And they're advocating this, and I haven't expanded my look at it.
I certainly go along with that. There's no problem.
Just a moment to tell the committee about a case which I did know about in Ketchikan. The judge was Judge Lauber. He's now a lobbyist down here. Oh, I don't know if he was here. At any rate, that particular case was interesting. It's the only one I ran into, but the only person who could translate what the deaf person was saying was the arresting officer. So the judge had to rely on the guy that arrested him to translate his statement and his testimony. And you can see, of course, Judge Lauber can tell you, fortunately, this was a very honest, good policeman, but I don't think most of us would want that to happen to us in court, which really demonstrates the need for this kind of legislation.
Thank you,
Mr. Wiggins.
Mr.
Buckner? Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
My name is Tom Buckner. I work for the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. I specialize in working with the deaf.
Is this in the Department of Social Services?
Education.
Oh, Department of Education. Go ahead, testimony.
Pardon?
Go ahead, Mr. Chang.
I work with deaf people. It's really important that we have legislation like this to protect the deaf. I've seen many, many examples where deaf people been brought to court without interpreters. In most cases, the deaf people are left free, which is not good. We see the deaf people get a pattern of coming back with crimes because they're not punished. Now that's just a few. It does not involve the people here. These are really fine people here that you have in the unit. So I recommend, you know, if possible, is to pass this legislation. You know, it's good for many, many reasons. I support it very much, and the deaf people do too. One problem that you have with deaf people is not just the inability to hear is a problem, it's language. So that deaf people have the same range of intelligence as the hearing, but they can't develop language. So that most deaf people who graduate from high school 19 or 20 years old, read about the third grade level. Then, after they're finished with school for a few years, they're back down to the second or the first grade level. So that the only way that they can communicate, and this is most deaf people, 40% are illiterate, can't read or write at all. And I think it's 60 or 65% read about the second, third grade level. The only way that they can communicate is by sign language, and it's different than English. Sign language is different than English. And they have to have an interpreter if there's going to be any justice at all. I'd like Arlie Dominguez to explain what happened to him one time when he was going to college at Seattle Community College in Washington. Did you tell that story? Okay. When I was driving on the street, I was driving and I was turning. Before I was looking behind me and I could see way back there and it was okay. And I was going to turn and I turned. But the woman was coming too fast and she hit me. I stopped. I got out, walked around. I saw the woman, she's okay. I wrote to a man to tell the police to come here. The police came. The police heard what the woman said, and she talked about what happened. She talked about most of what happened, but I couldn't do anything. I was stuck. I didn't know what to do. The policeman heard her story, gave me a ticket, and I had to go to court. So I decided to go to the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation for help. They gave me some help. I went to court. I had an interpreter with me. I explained what happened. I explained. Without the interpreter, I would have been stuck and I'd have gone to jail. But I won the case. The judge threw out the case because he understood your side of the story. Is that right? Yeah. That's just one example. In here, you have a what we call a high verbal deaf person. And I can show you many, many examples where we have the low verbal deaf people that, you know, would just sit back and not be able to protect themselves at all.
I saw some kind of a program on public television about deaf people and sign language. And I'd like to ask you some, it was more than I had ever heard about it before. They seem to be telling people that that sign language actually is a very sophisticated language, that is, what kind of it, or complicated. And that sometimes the differences, the small differences or nuances are they're even different from English. That's just a memory that I have of something I saw about 6 months or a year ago. Can you give us some more information about that? Because, of course, this is the kind of thing I was talking to Russ Meekins about, and pointing out why a written communication would not be the way to go.
Okay. When a hearing child develops language just by listening, and they don't do it consciously, and the language comes in, and they develop some very complicated rules of language syntax without knowing it. So a sentence like, I went to the store is easy. Any five-year-old can, you know, say that correctly. Mentally retarded people can say that correctly without any problem. But a deaf person doing that, say, or saying that sentence, it's a problem. It's a difficult thing. Because they have to remember, you know, where to put the subject, verb, you know, things like that. When a hearing child is 5 years old, they know about 25,000 words. A deaf person usually knows 50. So the only way the deaf person is going to develop a language is through signing, through watching signing. And signing is different than English. So they develop a different syntax. For example, if I say, I am happy to see you, in English, that's the way it comes out. If I sign it, the rules are different, and I end up saying, happy to see. I don't say I, because that's no one, I'm talking. You don't say am, because the verbs are not used. You sign happy. You don't use to. You just say see, this is see, eyes from here to there, and that creates a sight line, so you wouldn't say you. So the sentence ends up, happy see. And the deaf person reads that as, I am happy to see you. So those are the rules that he goes by. I can give you many, many examples like that. And it's different from English. Signs are different from words. They're a different concept than a word. For example, touch. If I say touch, it means that I might touch Charlotte. Or maybe I'll say, I touched Anchorage last week. And that the concept means that I stopped there for a short time last week. But the word touch doesn't mean that. So it's a difference. Does that explain the differences in the language?
So then there are some delicate differences about the way in which somebody translates from signing into English or from English into signing. It seems as though some of those differences are just like going from one oral language group to an entirely different tradition. And I suppose that would then give us a reason for seeing a need for
this bill rather than just assuming that it could be accomplished by handwritten communication. Is that a fair statement?
That's right. Really right. You know, most deaf people can't write or read. They can sign. They can communicate with me. They can communicate together, but they can't read. Or 40% are illiterate.
I have one more question. I don't know if it really relates to the bill, but it's something I'm curious about. There seemed to be some kind of a statement that there are some differences in meaning or shades of meaning that are that in sign language are very difficult to translate into English. Is that the case?
I don't understand. There are, like the people here, they could show me some signs, and I might say, I don't know, what's that mean? And they wouldn't know the word for it, and maybe there's not a word for it.
It's a full language difference then. All of the normal problems you have going through between two rather widely different languages.
There's difference. Like, you take one sign, like talk. You can say talk, which means I'm talking to you, or you can say talk, like we're talking back and forth, or we could say talk, I'm giving a lecture, or we could say talk, which means a bad thing. Talk. I don't understand what he's saying. That kind of complicated.
Well, that was the kind of thing I meant about very shades of differences that are not easily translatable into English, and you just gave an example of what I meant by the previous question.
The skill of the interpreter is important. There's no question about that. Who the deaf person is. You know, if the deaf person was born deaf, that means that he's probably going to be lower verbal. If he became deaf at age 15, he can write. Perfect, it's not a problem. He's already developed his language. But most of the time, nowadays, people are born deaf. You know, the good medicines and things, they don't become deaf later in life. We used to a long time ago.
Is there any questions from the committee members for Mr. Buckner? Mr. Buckner, do you have anything further, any more testimony?
No, I don't.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody here from the Department of Health and Social Services?
Thank you, sir.
Did you wish to testify?
This particular building, yeah.
Okay.
Do we have can we get some information in the court system? I know we're up against the deadline, and you want to know how.
Well, I'm sure we can, Mr. Brown. Just take time. I know. We just have to get a hold of it. Do you wish us to do that?
The representatives may be in town as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Mrs. Baskin.
I think that as far as my concern is concerned, maybe we don't have to hear from the court. If we adopt the proposed definition by the Department of Health and Social Services of a person in need of an interpreter as a person who has substantial physical hearing or speech or language impairment or who does not understand or communicate readily in English, that would cover the native people, the kind of thing that I'm talking about, as well as the deaf people who certainly need and deserve to have interpretation available to them. And if we added Mr. Brown's suggestion on some kind of inclusion of the word oral, perhaps in the last line, does not understand or communicate orally readily in English, to make it more grammatical than I'm suggesting. Then my concern about making it available to people who have just simply different languages would be met, and maybe it's not necessary to hear from the court system.
Right. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the court system has something, a program or a method they use. I'm not remembering right now what it is with regard to usual language differences, like from the native languages to English and so forth. So I don't know if we should be legislating in a vacuum on that or adding that to this bill without hearing from the court. For all I know, it may even be in the civil rules. There may be somebody in this room right now who can answer that question. And I'd at least like to hear from them about how they think they handle this problem. And I suspect from the testimony we've heard that whatever they're doing with regard to deaf people is it's not adequate. But I don't think we should put something in this bill, generalize it to all language
interpretation situations when the court system may well have something or have something in the works in the rulemaking process that we don't know about.
Okay. If there's no objection, then we'll hold the bill as Mr. Brown has suggested. And maybe we can find somebody from the to show up here today before the meeting's adjourned.
Well, I was going to say, let's get on with it. That's going.
Yeah.
Because this is an important piece of legislation, and I don't have any objection to what Mrs. Rudd said. I think it's just fundamental. If somebody's being interrogated or statements taken in a criminal action, or they're going to court, that they ought to understand what's going on. And regardless of what the court is doing, I understand where Mr. Brown's coming from, but it just doesn't seem to me that this would hurt anything they're doing. It just further requires that they do it.
I think Ms. Burke may be in. I don't know that.
Yeah, she was by here earlier, and I'm trying to get
her. Oh, okay, fine.
Okay, well, we can bring the bill up later in the committee meeting if we're unable to find that. Okay, so for the moment then, let's switch to House Bill 565.
Thanks, sir, for taking
this.
Mr. Chairman, I should have had a great amount of difficulty in the bill. This is about the third or fourth situation, Terry.
We have a proposed committee substitute here, and we have some brief testimony. Mr. Hickey would classify as a patient of the judicial
committee. Mr. Hickey?
Mr. Hickey, do you have the committee substitute?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
Are you going to testify in relation to the committee substitute?
I am prepared to.
Okay, go ahead.
For the record, my name is Dan Hickey. I'm the chief prosecutor for the state of Alaska. CS is too broad this time. They went too far on us. Since the CS, the amendment is kind of my request, yesterday they didn't go far enough in tightening up without it being the order. Today it's gone too far, so I just thought I'd co-opt you a little bit, and we may not be disagreeing with all you're going to say.
Okay.
Well, I have some substantial problems from a law enforcement perspective with both House Bill 565 as introduced and with the committee substitute. I don't know whether I would have those same problems with Mr. Brown's conception of what the amendment 565 should have been. As drafted in either form, the bill would have the effect of seriously interfering with investigative efforts of law enforcement agencies in the state. It is, for example, frequently the practice in the course of certain kinds of investigations that law enforcement officers are working what's referred to as undercover. In other words, it's not known to the people they're working with that they're law enforcement officers. And in the course of so doing, they're gathering evidence on particular offenses. The best evidence that can be gathered, generally, when that evidence consists of admissions, is an actual reproduction of those admissions. And that actual reproduction is produced by wearing a surreptitious recording device. This commonly takes place in virtually all undercover drug sales to law enforcement officers. It also commonly takes place in homicide investigations, arson investigations, kidnapping investigations, and the like. The bill would additionally have the effect of seriously interfering with the recording of confessions when an individual has been arrested, he has been advised of his rights under Miranda versus Arizona, and he has agreed to make a statement. It's common practice throughout the state that those statements are recorded. Defendants are like any other person. A lot of times when someone knows that they're going to be recorded, they don't feel as free talking. So people are commonly not informed that statements they're making, which are being made voluntarily and consensually, are being recorded. This statute would prohibit that practice, and it would prohibit, in my judgment, the collection and admission of the best evidence of statements made to the police. It isn't clear to me what evil this bill, as introduced or as now amended, is designed to address. My original understanding of House Bill 565 was that it was not addressed to concern expressed with respect to law enforcement practices, but rather for a concern involving practices between people in situations like negotiations over a union contract between labor and management, where one party would record another without telling them, or in a common situation, which a lot of people find very disconcerting and inappropriate, where someone records you on a telephone without telling you that they're recording you. Under present law, that is not illegal, both under federal and state law. To the extent that the concern is with practices involving the use of telephones, the concerns I express are somewhat alleviated because there isn't nearly the range of activity that takes place in conducting investigations that involve recording telephone conversations as there is with respect to party-to-party conversations on a face-to-face basis. I know that there's a certain amount of that that goes on as a law enforcement practice, but more important is the person-to-person contact. It seems to me that that first of all, the state of Alaska has one of the most restrictive provisions in the country on eavesdropping and wiretapping. We have, if you will, no statutory authorization for either. There is no ability in this state, for example, to obtain a search warrant to conduct a wiretap. That represents a whole different set of questions. But this amendment would further restrict that whole range of activity that's presently available to law enforcement agencies in conducting investigations, and I believe unnecessarily and inappropriately so. I think that the concern I understood which led to the bill could be addressed by simply excluding law enforcement or pursuant to an official investigation, some language to that effect, from the coverage of the bill, and I would recommend that to the committee. And if someone on the committee could enlighten me as to the purpose of the bill, perhaps I could respond a little further to that. But that's about the extent of my understanding of it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is, I think, the third, fourth, or fifth meeting we've had on this bill. We have had testimony previously from people who have mentioned the abuses which have, in fact, occurred. Some of the people who are concerned are the APSC, one of the public employee unions, about some abuses that have occurred as a result of the way in which personnel, state personnel, have been treated in investigations involving employee grievances being recorded when they did not know they were being recorded, in the way that this material had been misused. And there's been other examples of it. I think it'd be very easy to conjure up all kinds of things that aren't possible under this broad area. Now, the Constitution, 1972, was changed to provide for a right of privacy in charging the legislature with implementing it, and I think that's part of the charge. And I think that in spite of the problems outlined by Mr. Hickey, he hasn't pointed to anything that will greatly impede law enforcement. It may make procedures slightly different or make some things somewhat more difficult. I don't know if somebody's willing to make a statement. You ask, well, we're going to record it, or do you mind if we record it? I don't really believe in most cases they're going to say, hell no. I have a habit in my law practice of recording statements made by my clients with their permission when I'm interviewing them, and I do not find that people are averse to recording matters, even though they may be embarrassing to themselves or involve admissions. I have not found that in my experience. I think just having a broad exception to peace officers or to law enforcement investigations is just not the way to go. I much prefer a narrower one, even though Mr. Bradley still didn't quite get all the idea, and I think the subsection B of my committee substitute is much too narrow, and was not my intention when I suggested the amendment. I'm trying to redraft some stuff right now on that, but I understand where Mr. Hickey's coming from, but I really think we need the bill, and I think we can craft a modified version of the CS so that it'll address most of the kind of actual law enforcement and investigation needs.
Okay, there questions from other committee members?
Well, both. Maybe a question and a statement, too, but particularly a statement is somewhat in response to what Mr. Brown said. Maybe we're not too far apart on some things as far as I didn't, unfortunately, wasn't here and didn't hear the purpose of this bill. But at any rate, we can't take too lightly what we're doing as far as putting handcuffs on the police. If that's our intent, to further restrict the police to go out and catch guys, we can do it in this way and to endanger their lives. There's no question that any police officer can come here and tell you that time after time that we've sent people into very dangerous situations, and the only contact they have outside of a dangerous situation, maybe it's in a house buying drugs, or maybe they're going into a place to find out what's going on, is the contact they have by wearing a device so that they can keep in contact with what they're doing. They can only make buys. There's no other witness. So as long as, in our Constitution says that, our present law says that, as long as one person is aware of it. Now, there are times when I'm not, and we're not even arguing the point whether the police have the right to go out and bug telephones or eat and things like that. That's presently prohibited. But as far as the police officer being able to put some type of protective device on him when he goes into these dangerous situations, if we strip them of that ability and to collect evidence, I really hope we know what we're doing, because I think that very likely we're going to damage a great deal. And if there was some evidence that this has been misused, that's one thing. But I really think they ought to be exempted in that narrow scope of going out and collecting evidence from crime.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Hickey?
Well, I guess I do, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hickey, do you object to police officers or law enforcement officers having to get a court order before they eavesdrop?
Before they eavesdrop in the, no, in the constitutional sense of eavesdrop. Yeah. The constitutional sense of eavesdrop is basically this. It infers a surreptitious intrusion of a mechanical device into a constitutionally protected area for the purpose of listening. For example, if I inject a device into the wall of your house that will pick up conversations inside, I have absolutely no objection to that. What I do have objection to is asking the police to anticipate a situation where they're going to be collecting evidence, where they're going to be overhearing something that is not constitutionally protected, that the best evidence is the actual recording of it, and saying that there's something somehow magically different about that police officer coming into court and saying, I heard John Jones say X, Y, and Z, and actually saying, I not only heard John Jones say it, but here it is with him saying it. In, for example, a place where he has a legitimate right to be in overhearing that conversation. The problem with that is that there's almost no way, as given the situation Representative Dankert describes, of anticipating those kinds of situations in order to make some kind of a showing to a judicial officer, however you describe it, that would fulfill that requirement and result in an issuance of an order.
Further questions for Mr. Hickey?
Yes,
Mr. Hickey, on what basis are you deciding what is or is not constitutionally protected conversation or language? Are you taking into account what you anticipate might be the interpretation of the Alaska Supreme Court of the right of privacy?
Sure, absolutely.
And your interpretation must be very different from mine.
I guess it is, from what you said a few moments ago. With respect to the point about the recording of confessions where someone in the police station has agreed to speak and would be reluctant to do so, with a tape recorder going, for example. I thought the same thing that you did, but that's simply not true. When the bill was first introduced, I submitted it to all of our district attorney offices and asked for comments. And every office responded that this bill would be an absolute disaster in terms of that particular problem. That in certain places, Ketchikan, for example, being one, virtually 95% of all confessions taken are taken under those kinds of circumstances. I don't see within either the context of the Fourth Amendment, or more particularly Section 22 of the Alaska Constitution, that anyone who has been taken into custody on a probable cause arrest for, say, a felon, who is in the police station, who's been advised that he has the right to remain silent, that anything he says can or will be used against him, that he has the right to counsel, and if he can't afford counsel, counsel will be appointed for him before he says anything. I can't see where that kind of a person has any privacy interest at that point, when he understands those rights and he agrees to speak. And it's beyond me where a privacy interest can be asserted under Section 22 of the Alaska Constitution.
So this is the first time this year, isn't it?
No, second.
Once last year,
once the year before. Maybe not.
Don't ever disagree with
last year,
Rocket. Don't forget he's always right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'd like to address myself only to the sections of the bill that's numbered for N1. And I have no comment on Mr. Hickey's testimony. I'm not dealing with that aspect of the bill. I would simply like to say that based on a personal experience, the details of which I'd be happy to relate, I support Section 1 as opposed to existing law.
Why?
I was involved in a situation in which a party called me and, unbeknownst to me, tape recorded our conversation. And it became apparent later that the person who had called and was taping the conversation. Well, let me be more specific. I had written an editorial which was critical of the Board of Regents of the university. I think I had suggested that they ought to be fired instead of the president. And one of the regents took exception to that and several days later called me and to berate me for the tone and the substance of the editorial. And it was apparent in retrospect that the person who called me was attempting to entrap me into saying something injudicious. Happily, I didn't. As a matter of fact, the caller did. It was one of the members of the Board of Regents, Mr. Cook, in fact, Jeff Cook, who had initiated the call. When the call was concluded, he called me back to advise me that he had taped our conversation. But it was not until after the call was concluded and that I had been made aware of the fact that the call had been taped. I was outraged. I thought that this was an invasion of privacy. And I went back to Mr. Hickey to tell him that I would like to take whatever steps were necessary to file charges against Mr. Cook. And having first read the existing Section 116291, assuming that under that provision I had a case and that that the perpetrator of that call was guilty of violating that section, Mr. Hickey advised me that that was not the case because he read that provision differently than I did. And upon rereading it with his insight into it, I agreed that he was reading it correctly and I was not. The bill before you, the committee substitute, I think corrects the language so it would cover the kind of situation that I was involved in, and that's why I'm supporting this passage.
Any questions from Mr. Lavar?
Thank you. Okay, we can do this speedily. I want to take up another bill we haven't scheduled today, so this is going to take very long to hold it off. Does anybody have any amendments to the
I'll see Mr. Brown is working on this draft, and I'll be interested in seeing what he comes up with. But maybe while he's doing that, someone could answer for me the question on the last section in the CSD for a period not to exceed 60 days from the date of issuance, which seems different to me from the other sections which outline conditions which must be met before the take place, and D seems to be out of place. First of all, I would suggest moving it up to parent 1, may issue an order authorizing for a period not to exceed 60 days or something like that. But also, I wonder whether 60 days is desirable at all. Shouldn't we just have a situation where you can record for unspecific, under specific circumstances, but not just sort of an open-ended 60 days type?
I heard the very end of that because I was doing some head scratching. What is the problem with the 60 days per week?
So the one problem is that D seems to be out of place to me. The rest of the other three, A, B, and C, are conditions which must be met before the order is issued, and D is just saying that it can be issued for 60 days. The other problem is that I'm just questioning whether you want a period of time or whether it seems to me to open it up to just a sort of a fishing expedition type of 60 days of reporting somebody until you find what you're looking for. Whereas I thought we'd agree that it should be a fairly narrow circumstance and time and place.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would have no problem with that. 60 days was just picked out of the blue because Mr. Bradley wanted some period, and I had indicated, since I stated we wanted some time duration in the amendment. But, Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to, if I may, and this may help Mrs. Rudd's problem, I would have no problem reducing it to 20 or 10. I think it would be hard to make it less than 10 days. Maybe I'll write a 10 question mark there. But I think Legislative Affairs didn't get the idea. B is much too restrictive. It was not what I intended. Well, I don't think it was what the committee intended when we asked to have an amendment on this thing. I would propose to change B, and I'm going to read these, you know, much more slowly. So if people want to transcribe it, I'll read it fast now for the meeting. That B would be changed to read quite differently. That is, upon a showing that the eavesdropping will substantially aid an investigation of facts involving a felony described in A, that is, a felony that there's been probable cause shown as to. And I would also add after D, perhaps that'll be changed to 10 days, I don't know. After the word issuance, put in the word and, E, designating particularly the person or persons who shall be subject to the eavesdropping. And then I would, I think that we can address Mr. Hickey's problem, not with regard to all of the uses that were talked about by peace officers in use of doing tape recordings, but certainly in the area where a confession is being given after a binding waiver. And this is not artful, and perhaps it should be a little bit more carefully drafted, but the general idea is this. I would propose a section 2 that would say consent is implied under, in this previous named section, only when the person subject to the eavesdropping gives a binding waiver of rights involving self-incrimination and has agreed to provide public authorities with a statement regarding his activities. Now, perhaps that should be rewritten slightly. I have no problem with that. There you get into question to a binding waiver. I think if somebody knows, has consciously given a waiver and knows he has, then there's no problem recording the statement. Any abuse of rights would usually go to the question as to whether, in fact, he knew what he was doing when he gave the waiver, and that's a current question under law in any suppression hearing anyway. I don't see a problem with that. And still, I think it would give us most of the protection of the bill that we were looking for. And if Mrs. Rudd has a problem with 60 days, it was just kind of picked out of the blue. That would figure in CS. I think perhaps 10 days may be appropriate. I don't know what period you normally have a search warrant issued for, but I know usually that's limited in time and place also. And the intention was to have something analogous to a search warrant authority.
I need to move an amendment that, and the reason I'm going to move it on top of what Mr. Brown is proposing is because it's somewhat different. And if it were to pass, I think it would.
Everybody's problem is.
No, I think it's just a little different tack than Fred's taking. And it might save us, if it were to pass, I'd like to find out now, instead of going through all working on Fred's amendment. My amendment would, on line 11, after the word used, delete everything. And add the following language. By a law enforcement officer engaged in a criminal investigation.
No.
Okay. The reason,
no way.
You walk against it, right? But the reason I offer the amendment is that the original intention of the bill was to clean up a problem area that people are running around tape recording people who shouldn't be tape recording people and invading people's privacy. I don't think it's been demonstrated by any testimony that we have a problem with law enforcement officers who are tape recording people and invading their privacy, and they shouldn't be. So, in know, if there was testimony to that effect, I could see trying to work on that area, but it's never been brought to my attention that there is a problem with law enforcement officers and what they're doing in this area. So that's why I offered the amendment. I think we would still meet the original purposes of the bill, which was to meet a problem, and not create a new problem or get into a whole complex area of law enforcement officers and eavesdropping devices.
Mr. Chairman, your amendment wipe out everything after used, all the A, B, C, D.
Right. All language after that and insert by a law enforcement officer engaged in a criminal investigation. In other words, just saying law enforcement officers are exempt from
what I proposed two meetings ago.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'm a little slow catching on.
That's what you.
Okay. Discussion on my amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I hope that Mr. Miles will reconsider embracing your amendment because I think that when we have a bill like this and it does impinge upon a privacy issue, I think we have a responsibility to carefully examine the matter. And I think that we are talking about invasion of privacy. I think that the kind of thing that should allow an invasion of privacy should rise to the level of a warrant that is used to invade what would normally be the right against unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, Mr. Chairman, in 1971, I drafted the first bill that was going to go in this direction, and I put a provision in there about writs of investigation. The Senate committee did not buy it, and they even made it broader. And I think that we've got to have something rise to the level of something like a warrant. And Bill is shaking his head and indicating that I'm an idiot or something, but obviously he's the swing vote on the subject. But I really feel very strongly about it. Well, don't die.
You've
got to vote on Al Petco on
Move your motion.
Mrs. Red.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with Fred. And you mentioned that the case is that you're not aware of any problems and so on, and I'm not either. But that doesn't mean that I don't think that we should protect people before we hear about any problems. I think that this is such a basic matter of right, and if Fred cares to see it as a right of privacy, that's fine with me. Whatever kind of right it is, it seems so basic and fundamental to me that it should be protected without our having to point to invasions of it before we act to protect it. So I don't like your amendment. Mr. Chair, may I just finish? I did have another thought. What we're doing is protecting people from arbitrary uses of power. And the reason I like the CS, although I think it needs some work, but the reason I like it is because you have that checking mechanism. The police have to go to the court, and the court has to agree that, yes, this is worthy of doing something that's outside the law otherwise. This is an issue or a case that's worthy of it. And that's the only reason they have it. It's to put some kind of a check on what could otherwise be an arbitrary and capricious, if you want to use that word, it could happen, use of power. It's just a way of making sure that that kind of thing doesn't ever arise in the state.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Miles.
I agree with what Fred and Lisa have to say, but when I offered the original amendment a couple of days ago, it was sort of in the spirit of these problems that they bring up really haven't arisen. And if they do arise, then we may have to change the law, but let's not create a tremendous maze, legislative maze. I mean, let's just go ahead and solve what the problem is. If additional problems come up, we can address them then. But let's not say it in 100 words when we can say it in 5.
Mr. Brown.
Well, of course, there's a vast difference, I think, between the amendments I've suggested here at the CS, and I think we can move it out and it will be fine. I don't have anything further there, and I actually have it all written down here. But we're talking about a situation where people can be sitting around with rafts and rafts of tape recordings of your conversations that you thought were confidential. Whether they were said confidential to a peace officer or something like that is not the question. Now, this is exactly the kind of of area that I think the right of privacy was intended to protect, and not just by me, but by the legislators who voted for it, by the people who voted for it in 1972, by about 75% of the popular vote or something like that. It's something rather unique to Alaska. I think it's very important. It's going to be much harder to do this 5 years from now if the police say, great, we've got a blank check here, and it's now specifically in the law. We've got an enforcement tool. People are getting sub-miniaturization and electronics is getting so incredible now that you get a tape recorder, a recording device that is, you know, smaller than this pencil to some extent. And everybody likes, this is the age of gadgets. Are we going to have miles of tape of Bill Miles conversations that he thought were confidential ones, not knowing there were tape recordings, and are they going to come back and haunt him 3, 4, or 5 years later when he believed he was in a privacy situation because somebody was a peace officer? That's the broad kind of check you're giving. Now, the amendment I've got here, I think, gives the law enforcement agencies the right to use this kind of capability when they really need it, including the provision that addresses the problem of recording the confession statement. Now, I'll bet you, at least right now, the large majority of cases where law enforcement officers use a recording device is taking down a confession in the police station. And I think the amendment of Section 2 I propose takes care of that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's a lot of that is, you know, and it's rhetoric about what the police have been doing with that. I happen to have some experience with it. We're leaving the impression that there's no checks and balances by the courts in anything that police do. Not any of this, number one, can be used against any citizen unless it can stand the test of evidence as it goes into court. If any police illegally took any statement that's not covered by the Constitution or the present law, it won't be admitted against any person. The police know the rules under which they play. The purpose for this legislation, and much like the one Mr. LaRocque agreed with, I have no objections to, as we get into these areas, particularly outside the police. But I don't think, as Mr. Miles said, that we don't have any evidence of that. I happen to know that the police have to stand the court test if they misuse it. Secondly, we were terrifically handicapped, particularly in drug investigations in this day. We would really be handcuffing the police unnecessarily. They'll still have to stand the test in the court if they misuse it. I really think that, like you said, that you're addressing the problem that we had without handicapping our police for something they haven't done and that would still have to stand the test.
We're going to have to stop on this bill because I've got all these other people here that want to.
We haven't voted on your amendment.
I know. Mr. Chairman, this is going to take a long time. So another bill I wanted to take this one. It's in the voice calendar. Unless you're not.
Mr. Chairman, I hope you're not going to cut off the debate before we vote on
it. No, I think we're going to hold the bill over for tonight.
With the amendment pending?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. We need it tonight, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I just want to get these bills out because we agreed to get them out this week.
We can meet tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night?
I'll get to the committee room. You
can meet in my committee room tomorrow night if you want. You can meet
my committee room
if you want.
Okay, well, let's hold this off now. I'd like to take this one, House Bill 912. Okay, we'll meet tonight then.
On what, just this or a couple
of things? Well, we got the other bill we took up this morning. And we have one other thing.
Huh?
On okay,
7?
Is this the last one for now? Or?
Yeah.
That be 10 o'clock tonight?
One question. Is there anybody from out of town that's here to testify at the hospital night?
Okay,
so we
912.
Coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Dan Benedictson, Managing Director of the Alaska Trucking Association. My association made up some 17,000 employees throughout the state who deliver food, necessities of life, and fuel. We're pretty concerned about the entire area of oil spills, obviously since we deal in a great deal of movement of oil over the state's highways. Something about my industry, very few of my carriers are pure carriers in the sense that you find with a yellow freight or a consolidated freightways in the lower 48. Rather, by far and away, the majority of my members, I have 600 member firms that belong to my association. I have various authorities. They may, for example, have household goods moving authorities as well as those carry, allowing me to carry fuel. And we are typically, especially in the area of fuel, rather small companies, small firms. The handling of fuel by truck is an absolute necessity for the survival of most of the communities and the cities in Alaska. Without the necessary and requisite tank truck or deliveries of your home heating oil, many of my members and their constituents could not actually physically survive. The subject that you have before you is House Bill 912 concerning mandatory oil spills. Last half session, the legislature passed House Bill 137, which, while apparently based on good intentions, we feel was bad law. The intent, as far as we determined for the bill, was twofold: to provide an incentive to ensure safer handling of large quantities of oil, and two, to place dollars in the general fund to offset environmental repair costs for damage resulting, again, from large oil spills. Unfortunately, what happened with the passage of that law was the vote within AS 4303758, which is a subject dealt with in House Bill 912, is that the small oil carrier is placed in a position where he can be served with an arbitrary fine for an oil spill, regardless of the actual environmental damage. Now, that fine can be very significant when you look at the size of my particular member companies. In fact, we probably put a large majority of my people out if the fines were imposed as they can. I've attached as the last two sheets. I'm sorry, I hope you received copies of my testimony.
No, I haven't.
No. Oh, here.
Thank you, yeah.
Like that?
Yes. I've attached as a worksheet the last two sheets of the medical statement what can be assessed in terms of the civil penalties. And if you notice, in loss number one, for a 5,000-gallon oil spill in a freshwater critical environment, working through the mechanics as I've done, you come up with a penalty of $23,300 right off the top. If there's gross negligence involved, that same carrier is facing a possible fine of $116,500, if my math is correct. On the second case, I've dealt with the same category of material, that is marine diesel rather than home heating fuel, and worked through a similar process with a marine critical environment. As an example, within 1 mile of a salmon spawning stream. Again, you come out with some fairly horrendous figures, $2,330 worth of fine, or with negligence, $1,650. House Bill 912 was proposed to eliminate the small oil spill from penalties against which the operator cannot even be insured. I think this is a critical point. With a penalty of this nature, as spelled out in the law as it is, I can't go out to my friendly insurance company and get a dollar's worth of coverage. I'm stuck with that coming out of the top if the penalty is imposed. There's a companion bill in the House, Senate Bill 557, being processed through the Senate, which essentially accomplishes the same thing which House Bill 912 does. It's going to be our recommendation when 557 is heard that providing 912 stays in its present form, that the Senate adopt the version which is created over here. The wording, I think, on this side of the legislature's bill is better. The 12,000 gallons is certainly adequate for us. Now, the 12,000 gallon figure really, I guess, was derived by me and my association initially. I went out with a poll, told all of our members that I could lay my hands on who carry fuel oil, and I simply asked them, what's the largest gallonage that you run the roads with? The largest gallonage I got is a little under 11,500. So I recommended, and it was adopted, that we go, initially I suggested we go to the 12,500 figure, with the thought that as equipment is developed, bigger tanks, lighter carriages and whatnot, you're going to have a buffer in there to take care of the natural development and the ongoing development of tank trucks. So that's where the 12,000 came from. It was reduced to 12,000, but we support this very strongly and are extremely happy with the figure of 12,000 and feel that it will provide the adequate protection for the small operator and meet the intent of the law as passed last year. On behalf of the association, Mr. Chairman, we thank you.
Thank you.
I thank you kindly for the chance to speak, and I'm most happy to field any questions. Yes, sir.
Brown. Chairman, I have no problem with most of his testimony. I know where the bill's needed, and I think I'm in favor of it. However, the way he read his statement, the way his statements read, it makes it read as though he represents the employees. I think he represents the member firms.
Yes, the member firms.
If I'm to believe his testimony on the unemployment bill in my committee. Secondly, I just have a question I'd like to ask about the Alaska Trucking Association. Maybe it's a dumb question. What is its relationship to the Alaska Carriers Association?
Okay. For the 18 years, the Alaska Carriers Association existed as a combination of trade association and tariff bureau. As a result of the passage of Ex Parte 297 by the Interstate Commerce Commission in 1955, we were required to split the association into two parts. You could no longer have a trade association representing tariffs and vice versa. The tariff section, which remained on as the Alaska Carriers Association, which exists right now, is simply a tariff bureau only. The rest of the functions, our functions from insurance through safety through legislative lobbying, are now done by the Alaska Trucking Association.
Are most of the members the same?
Yes.
Okay. How long has the Alaska Trucking Association as such, because for this reason, existed?
Officially, the Alaska Trucking Association came into being on 1 July of last year.
Oh, okay.
But we just simply, you know, took the same functions and moved them over here to satisfy the Interstate Commerce Commission.
Other questions for the witness?
Thank you.
Are the witnesses like to speak on this?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gene Wiles, and I'm a lobbyist for Chevron USA, Inc. In relation to the present bill, we agree with the testimony that the Truckers Association put on, but we feel that the bill doesn't go far enough, and that there are other people that are involved that are affected by the original bill that was passed last year, which was House Bill 137. Just as a little background, what 137 did was actually created a type of law that at least I've never been familiar with before. It creates a criminal, a civil penalty that has nothing to do and no relation to the damages that are caused. In other words, in a larger spill, and under the regulations that have been promulgated by the department now, there could be civil penalties up to $100 million. And basically the operator, or the one who made this bill, could go out and clean it up and do an excellent job, and there would be actually no environmental damage. Yet there's this tremendous fine. Now the bill itself says that it's not to be punitive, and yet what else can it be? When you're putting a civil fine in that nature, when there's no damage or little damage. So what the bill 137 did was allow the Department of Environmental Conservation to just get on an adding machine or a calculator and say, well, you spill so many gallons, and this is what the damages are going to be, regardless if there's any actual damage at all.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to that wasn't the point of the bill, Gene. I think you're misrepresenting. The point was that you cannot determine what the damages are. It's impossible to determine what the damages are. You keep saying little damage or no damage. That's not necessarily so. The point of the bill was that it's impossible to determine what damages are. So we must set up a scale not based on the damages, because no one can say, neither you nor I can say what the damages are.
Well, it was intended as a schedule of liquidated damages, basically.
Well, but in that respect, it's penal, because if there are no damages and you're paying this huge fine, why?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Redd?
I'd like to protest discussing last year's bill. Let's talk about this year's bill.
Well, in order to get into last year's bill, this bill.
We all were here and we all worked on it in this committee, so we're all familiar with it.
There's new members of the committee. I don't want to argue
about it. There's not any new members of the committee.
Okay. Mr. Wiles, continue.
I would like to extend this the amendment to the bill I think if it's fair for a small operator to not be under this, if they can't figure out the damages on a $12,000 bill, or they can on a 12,000 gallon spill, how can they, why can't they figure it out on a 12,001 gallon spill? I mean, it would appear to me that either there are damages or there are not damages. And so in this respect, I would like to submit amendments to this happens to be meant for paragraph SB 557, but would also be for 912.
How much of a difference is there? Will they also apply to the CS, the Cavada Resources Committee?
Yes.
Well, I guess, okay. Right. They just changed some numbers, but the rest of their structure looks the same. I guess it is.
And the only change they made in the resources was they changed that figure from 12,500 to 12,000.
Yeah, 5 to 12. Okay. I guess all the amendments would be appropriate for either one then. Do you have those there?
Yes, I do. And I'll just, what basically, you can read this, and basically what it does is it says, however, it is not the intent of this section to impose a civil penalty for discharge of oil where there is no demonstrable damage to the environment. In other words, there has to be some showing of damage before the penalties will go into effect. I'd like to keep warm.
Actually, this has already been passed out.
Is this it?
That's it. Oh, is that the same thing? Oh, we already have that. That's from them?
Right.
Okay. Let me write that down.
House Bill 912. Does that conclude your comments?
Yes, it does. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer my... as a lawyer, this concept of civil penalties when there's no damages is very new to me, and very... I just don't understand it.
Dean, I gather that it's your opinion that it would be easier to prove damages on 12,000 or less if they were dumped on the ground or in a stream than it would be if we get up into maybe some dump in the middle of the ocean where they can't prove it.
Well, I don't know that they can prove it. We went through this last year, and Mrs. Rudd is cutting me off on this, but we presented testimony last year where that in effect there hasn't been any demonstrable damages shown even years after the oil spill. And we have a 50-page outline of the cases and the studies that have been made with me here if you'd like to see it and take a look at it.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Dankler, for you, Doug?
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Rudd.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as I remember, when we passed this bill in the House, we had a $10,000 gallon lower limit on the spills that would fall under the bill that we passed last year. And
five.
Well, wherever it was, and it was taken out in the Senate, as I recall. So this bill is now before us. I'm willing to support. I may have a problem with the amount of gallons, but I'm willing to support it because I think that there were some problems on small spills that were brought to us last year. But I'm not willing to open up the whole bill that we passed last year, which, as I glance at Mr. Wiles' amendments, that's what he's doing. He's, for instance, in this first section, as I glance at it, and I think I understand it, it opens the whole bill, not just the 12,000, but the whole thing up to, it's not the intent of the section to impose a civil penalty for discharge of oil where there's no demonstrable damage to the environment, which really changes the entire bill that we passed last year. I liked that bill that we passed last year. I don't want to play around with it, and if there's any danger that we're going to change that basic bill that we passed last year in any stage of this bill, which is trying to address a specific problem which the House recognized last year, then I'm going to do everything in my power to stop it from passing. I'm willing to work on the 10 or 12 or 5 or however many thousand gallons exemption. But to open up the bill before we've even really had an oil spill since that time, and undo all the work that we did last year and trying to come up with something that was equitable and fair, I just, you know, that really disturbs me.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree with Mrs. Rudd. However, I do have a question for Mr. Wiles regarding these amendments. Were these amendments offered to the Resources Committee when they were considering the bill as well?
Yes, they were.
And they were not adopted?
Pardon me?
They're apparently not adopted yet.
That's correct.
Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The proposed amendment doesn't disturb me at all because what we did last year was neither equitable nor fair.
Dankworth.
I think we went through this last year. I still believe it was a bad law. It is a bad law because we have denied people the right to court, and this is basically correcting that basic principle we've got in our law that everybody should be able to go to court and prove those damages. We just come up with the idea we don't. So that's being repetitious. I've already argued against it. I think it's a terrible law, and I support the amendment. I'd like to see us be able to do it. I noticed that the funny thing happened here, and we're talking about 5,000, and then someone came up on the floor, I believe Mr. Gardner, he prayed his vote might be included, so he raised it to 10,000. The Senate must have put it back to 5, I didn't know they did that. Now we've got some other people that might spill 15,000 or 10,000 gallons in a salmon stream, and they say, well, that might get us in trouble, so we'd like to get excluded, so now we move it to 12,000 so we can exclude those people. This to me, this one law should affect everybody and every business, and we just obviously singled out one particular area that we don't want to excuse everybody else from the law. So philosophically, I guess, is my opposition to it. I think this is the wrong way to do a law in this state, and no matter what we're trying to get at, everybody in the country can figure out how to catch crooks, how to do all kind of bad things if you can get around the court, if you don't have to go prove it. And that's basically what this has done. We said we can't prove it, so we'll do it anyway. And so I would feel remiss if I didn't bring it to the committee to deal with that. Exactly what we've done, and that's my objections to the law. Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter, I forgot to add one thought. I received a letter, as I suspect others did, from the District Fisheries Union, and it said, I'm paraphrasing liberally, but I'm totally accurate on the thrust, that we were damn fools for allowing something so unfair as this to exist for fishing boats. And then went on to say, but it's okay for everybody else. Well, the logic of that escapes me. If it's grossly unfair, and I believe it is, for fishing boats, then it's as grossly unfair in its concept of strict liability for everyone else.
I'd just like to make one comment. I'd like to see these amendments. I wouldn't want to see the bill killed. I think it would help someone out, because I don't agree with the philosophy at all. I don't think it applies to, should apply to anyone. But if somebody can get out from under it, I have no objection to that. But I'd like to see it extended equally to everyone. I certainly do, you know, have no objection to this bill. I think it cures some of the unjustness that's in the original.
Any other questions for a while? Thank you, sir.
I'm going to be extremely brief because most everything that I had to say has either been covered or precluded. I'm Ken Showalter, Director of Alaska Government Affairs for Sonora. I support the amendments that are offered by Mr. Wiles. However, if the committee does not favor those amendments, then I would urge you to approve the 12,000-gallon exemption, because it does improve the law in the sense that on smaller spills, they get their day in court, while you don't on a larger one. Thank you.
Mr. Brown.
Well, the long and short of it is, if we don't adopt the amendments, you support the Resources Committee substitute.
Isn't that the figure they've got in there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Other questions from the committee? Mr. Carpenter?
Not a question, but a statement in relation to the amendment exempting 12,000 gallons and under. I want the record to show that I'm an officer and stockholder in Interior Energy Corporation, which is a company that's in business distributing fuel out of Fairbanks and has tank trucks ranging from 2,300 gallon capacity to 9,300
gallons. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Shaw.
Is that 5 shares in a bankrupt corporation?
I want to move an amendment or deduction of that testimony. I'm sorry.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ernie Muller, and I'm the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. And I understand that the Judiciary Committee and the Attorney General discussed the bill that was subsequently introduced by the Judiciary Committee. And it was amended in the House Resources Committee to change the quantity involved. I think, to some extent, the volume that was suggested in the initial bill probably was a little arbitrary. I'm not sure that any volume involved is not arbitrary. I think what we're looking at here is oil spills as opposed to the size of a person's business venture, at least from our standpoint. The 5,000 gallon figure that was originally in there perhaps could be considered to be a logically determinable maximum size of a typical oil spill from a fuel distribution operation rather than the maximum possible size of an oil spill from a fuel distribution operation. The administration, while I think that the legislature is aware, we feel that the combination of the civil penalties bill that passed last year, plus the flexibility that is given the courts in certain matters with the bill that passed last year, plus the what might be called the discretion of the executive branch to decide whether or not to file charges against someone, we do have sufficient flexibility to solve the problem with Mr. Nixon raised. I think that the administration is certainly not opposing either the committee substitute or the House bill from the standpoint that we understand the problem he's talking about. We feel we can handle it administratively, but I think he wants a greater assurance that will happen. And, I can sympathize with that. If there's any questions that the committee may have, we can certainly have the answer.
Yeah. Mrs. Rudd.
Ernie, it's occurred to me as we listen to his testimony that maybe we're making our decisions on how many gallons should fall under one category or the other on the wrong basis. It seems to me that maybe we should make the decision based on how many gallons are usually disturbing to an environment, whether it's water or land, or maybe we should make it on the basis of what is the, if you look at all the oil spills that have taken place over the last 10 years, where is there a logical cutoff between what you call a small spill and a large spill, rather than at what the various carrying capacities of various trucks and boats are. Because, I mean, it doesn't really matter what the carrying capacity of a truck or boat is. What matters is what is the potential damage, and where is there maybe a logical cutoff between small spills and big spills. If you look at a series of numbers, usually you find a logical break somewhere along the line. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, perhaps it could. I think probably in the analysis there would find that if you're looking at something like 95% of all the spills are probably 100 gallons or less. And in those cases, we don't even bother with it. It's not worth the cost of investigating the matter to then seek some kind of recovery. It's the 5% that really is the total of the vast bulk of the amount of oil that's spilled into the environment and those that produce the greatest amount of damage. But again, we'd have to look at a damage assessment situation, which we attempted to do in developing both the law last year and the regulation system, and predicted way of what that civil penalty would be based on. The only thing I could give you with a lot of work, could give you some statistics on oil spills that we have information on, because which actually is pretty good in some cases. But I think you would see the curve kind of follows the national trend of a very large number of very small spills down to a very small number of very large spills. I think Mr. Benedictson was correct that the bill was introduced in last year. Our concern was primarily over the spills of the type of Amoco 50, Torrey King, bars of Tamarama, and these very, very large oil spills, as opposed to the small, which under the existing law, they are subject to substantial civil penalties with a little more flexibility in how those penalties are assessed.
What about a 12,000 gallon spill? I mean, what is the bulk of 12,000 gallons? Is it as big as this room, or bigger, or smaller?
He's got a slide to it.
He does.
It
would
be,
it to be one-third this term.
Yeah, yeah. Fourth to a third.
Okay. If what's... What, no, I'm still disturbed about if you spilled 11,900 gallons...
As opposed to 12,000.
As opposed to 12,000 a month. I'm still thinking that, somewhere there must be a logical break. Maybe it's 100,000 rather than 12,000.
If you spill 11,999 instead of 1201, you give the guy who calculates what you're carrying a bonus.
You're going to be surprised if you get fined $25,000 instead of $4,000.
Mr. Carpenter?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that you would correct me if I'm wrong. I think the point is that different parcels of the environment have different values. For example, with that 12,000 gallon tank truck rolled onto the Hall Road and spilled itself in the Deep Creek River, and we've got a lot of problems, whether it's 12,000 gallon or 5,000 gallons. If it did it down on off the Richardson Highway in the Donnelly Flats, frankly, who cares? It depends on the value of the environment that's being invaded by the oil.
Donnelly Flats is going to blow away anyway. It's been the wind's been blowing places.
Yeah, but that was the point of the original bill. I mean, that the determination on the fine was dependent on the receiving environment and the toxicity of the oil and so on. Whereas the 12,000 gallons is a differently arrived at figure and under 12,000. I don't know what the answer is, but it seems whatever we arrive at will be a highly political decision, I'm sure.
Larry, what size did you say you're fuel trucks were?
The largest one is 9,300 gallons.
9,300. Is that pretty standard?
Well, pretty much so.
I mean, that's the one we see driving around taking oil to somebody's house.
Oh, no, that's what you're watching here. For example, here in Juneau, the smallest one you would see would be 1,600 gallons right around up here. Around Campbell. And 2,300 gallon clue tanks and 2,600 gallon tanks that you'll see commonly running around also, going a little bit farther out. And the biggest you'll see really would be a 3,000 gallon tank truck, maybe delivering places out in the valley. But that's the common range of truck used by distributors around here at Juneau that you'd be seeing.
They run it to about 6,000, I guess, the people that serve the services.
Any other questions for Commissioner Long? Thank you, Commissioner.
I'd like to propose some amendments. I would like to propose these amendments that Mr. Wild put them on, and that you already have them on the lead. There's 1, 2, and amendments 3 and 4, as you find out. I can read them into the record, but since this is probably a part of the record, I won't do it. But I'm moving these amendments to correct this law and make it up. Does everybody understand what the amendment is? I guess it's clear enough.
Is any comment on the amendment? Yes. Do it. Take it, Chair.
I just ask. Oh, there he is. He just arrived. Figured since, you know, introduced by the judiciary.
Well, we've got an amendment, Senator.
Chairman,
I heard the amendment.
It's the Chevron Amendment, Mr. Chairman.
No, it isn't. It's the Dankworth Amendment, trying to correct something that's horrible that we adopted.
It's a shorthand method of identifying.
I think it does make the law at least stay within the Constitution and a few other things that we do have a right in our day in court.
Ready for the question?
No
You can't even see it. Just tell like the where's the translator?
If you had the optometrist in here yesterday, would have given you some free glasses.
Do you need my vote on this? I need to make a vote bigger.
All those in favor, raise the right hand. Opposed? Amendment fails.
How many times have I abstained?
motion on the bill?
Who are the resources?
Three to two.
Are you going to fly one?
I'd like to go back to the 5,000 gallons. I'll move 5,000 rather than 12,000.
Okay.
Chair, are you going to take over this? Are you just going
to? Go ahead.
Sir, I need the practice.
I need the practice.
You need the publicity.
I haven't been out of committee so long.
I'm not getting any lately.
So, discussion on the amendment.
What was the?
She wants to reduce it back to 5 kilowatt gallons.
Put your boat back in it.
What did the department say? I know what the amendment is. What did the department say that they'd love 5 above 12?
They said they'd like about 3 gallons.
Just think about the capacity of your boat, Terry.
Yeah, how many gallons does your boat carry?
Oh,
220
gallons.
Oh, okay.
220, what? I'll amend Mr. Red's motion to 210.
You can put my boat inside 12,000 gallons.
Chairman, that's boat.
Question on the 5,000 gallon amendment. All those in favor signify by raising their right hand. All those opposed, same sign. Amendment failed.
Anybody buy six?
Move the bill. Move the resources, CS. Chairman, I move the resources, CS.
Discussion on the motion. All those in favor, raise the right hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All those opposed, same sign.
Where do I sign?
It's sign.
Carried.
Well, we move one bill to the new
Before everybody leaves,
we are going to bring a 565 tonight, right?
Well,
I'm calling my secretary back to type up for this thing.
All right, the main purpose of the meeting tonight is to take up these two bills.
565.
If we thought we could take them up shortly now, we could do that and not come back at 7 o'clock tonight.
Let's do it now.
565,
is that...
Well,
which two are we talking
about? Well, I don't know.
I'd like to have my amendment reading.
Well, we don't need anybody.
Mr. Chairman, why don't we ask Fred to come back with a new CS? It would be much better.
Okay, can we take up Russ's bill?
I'll try to have this clean in our meeting. If we have only 565 up at 7, we should be super short, you know. I'll have it nice and clean.
Let's take up Russ's bill.
Council 837. Did we find out anything in the court system? Okay. I don't want to delay. Russ's bill. Let's take up House Bill 837.
Okay, we were having a clean substitute prepared.
Well, we didn't decide what to do. I'll make a motion. Let me make one motion. On page 1, delete line 22 through 27. On page 2, delete lines 22 through 29. On page 3, delete 22 through 28. That is, deletes subsections 1 and 2.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
And I put a period after the last word in subsection B.
Mr. Chairman.
Mrs. Wilson.
I amend your amendment to delete the word if on the last section that just precedes that. Put the period after the word before.
Right? Okay. I accept that. I should amend that.
I go along with that. You're not going to meet tonight if we get this bill out.
Right.
Because I just called my secretary back.
Make another telephone call, right? Okay, is there any objection to that amendment? There's no objection to the amendment, Doug. Russ, which one when do you want to read? Deaf or a person in need of interpreter?
I think that would include somebody that didn't speak English, and I would rather have deaf. We can address that elsewhere. I'm not trying not to address it, it's already addressed, I think.
I don't know whether it's addressed or not.
Several years ago, they had the Bush Justice thing came in, Snowden came in with this big program to provide interpreters to Bob Hicks and Judith. And I know they did something about it, and I don't know that it's in the law.
I'm willing to accept.
Okay. The motion is, now let me, let's, wherever it says handicap, change it to deaf in the bill. That's the amendment.
Okay.
Is there any objection to that amendment?
Ask unanimous consent.
Okay, there's one more amendment now.
Now you have a definition
amendment. In the definition, every time handicapped person definition appears, the last phrase, because he is deaf or because he has a physical hearing impairment or physical speaking impairment, should appear up on the top line after the word who. So it would read, deaf person means a person who, because he is deaf or because he has a physical hearing impairment or physical speaking impairment, cannot
readily understand. That's clever.
Could you do that in all
your
three
idea?
Definitions?
Very sharp.
Move that amendment.
Highly educated.
Ask unanimous consent.
Clearly magnified.
All right, is there any objection to that? There's no objection.
Very heavy. Very brilliant.
Okay.
Move it. Move it. Approve. Sign. What do I sign?
Yeah.
You're against it. I'm for it.
Good deal,
I
think.
I'm just
wasn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Seeing that guy.
That was a real mind blower. I sit here blind as bad.
We're adjourning, and I'll bring it back at 5:65 change tomorrow, Mr. Chairman.
I had an interpreter
okay.
for the deaf, and had six or seven deaf people here testifying on the deaf.
Yeah,
deaf.
It was really
and
great.
He would speak
sign language.
It was fascinating. Just fascinating.
The TV camera should have been here. They would have gone bananas over that.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Well, I used to play football with Tom, and he had a lot of we had a lot of deaf people on the team, and I was the quarterback, and I used to have to call, like, this would be a power right and a power left and pass and stuff. And they'd all play, that's how you call them. And then, one of the problems we ran into is that the referees wouldn't let the deaf guys back up from the line when they played end.
What was that?
They couldn't hear us. They couldn't hear the call. They'd have to watch for the snap.
Yeah.
And therefore, they couldn't line up on the end. They had to back up, which would make them backs, and the rest would call them out of place. And I'd say, look, you idiot, the guy can't see unless he backs off the line, and then you call him offside, you know? And so I even ran into problems there. So.